One Man Family, winner of 47 national awards, a Carlton E. Morse creation. One Man's Family, now in its 27th year, is dedicated to the mothers and fathers of the younger generation and to their bewildering offspring. Chapter 37, Book 133 of the Barber Family Saga. Today, The Suspect. An elderly gentleman suffering through a sleepless night, which under the circumstances is not surprising, wanders downstairs. And with a glance at the kitchen clock, he opens the refrigerator. Then, to his blank amazement...
Yes, telephone at 2 o'clock in the morning.
He hurries down the long hall until hearing Hazel's voice. He stops outside the library, not intentionally eavesdropping, but stunned by what he hears.
Thank you for calling back, Mr. Droy. Oh, I see. I left word at the Detective Bureau. Where are you now? Oh, good. My brother Paul wanted me to tell you he's heard from Ross Farnsworth.
Huh?
He's at the Tejada Hotel, room 407. Well, before you go, my sister Claudia is home from the clinic, and she insists she did not say that Ross Farnsworth fired the shot.
Yeah.
My father thought Claudia said Ross Farnsworth, but she denies it.
Yeah.
Hmm? Pardon me. Is someone in the hall?
Yes.
Oh, for goodness sake. Come in, Father. All right, Mr. Drury. I won't keep you. Thank you very much. Father, how long have you been out there?
Oh.
You're supposed to be in bed. You know what Dr. Thompson said, and Hank, too.
Which Mr. Drury is this?
He's a friend of Paul's from the Detective Bureau. Did you hear everything I said?
Probably not. Tell it again.
I'm sure you heard enough. Why would Ross go into hiding and then tell Paul where to find him?
Borderline psychotic, I suppose. That's why. Yeah, yeah. Room 407. That sounds familiar.
Yes, who is it?
Ross, Paul Barber.
Are you alone?
No, Hank's with me.
Pardon? Oh, Hank, but no one else?
Open up, Ross.
Good of you to come so promptly. Well, well, the Major and Lieutenant, my military period. Do come in, gentlemen.
Don't bother to lock the door. I'll take care of it.
Nervous, Hank? Let me reassure you at once. Here, Paul, I want you please to open the desk drawer. No, there to your left. You'll find a revolver, a little beauty. Examine it, please. Hmm? Is that a gem? It's a new type of synthetic material manufactured for small fry TV fans who need a realistic-looking weapon with which they may go... Open it. Aren't those bullets authentic-looking? Did Jack try to fire the one he so rudely wrested from me?
I didn't see it. Did you, Hank?
No, I was pretty busy.
Well, it's the twin to this one. In spite of the unpleasant publicity, I hope you don't think I would ever be so careless as to take a real gun into the nursery with my children.
Have you seen the morning papers?
Hmm. That's why I called you. The Barbers, with customary impetuosity, jumped to the wrong conclusion that I had invaded my former wife's wedding and fired indiscriminately, striking Penelope. I intend to sue, you know. I can show damage to my reputation. I have an airtight alibi for my movements from 6 o'clock on.
What is it? Where were you at 7 o'clock?
That is the key question, isn't it, Hank? I accepted the urgent invitation of a former colleague, Brooks Phillips, to dine with him and his family at El Español. That's where we were while Joan was being married. There were 7 witnesses in our party. I was at table from 6:45 until a little after 8 o'clock. In short, I did not attend the wedding, did not fire the shot, and can prove it beyond question. Have you a comment, Paul?
That's very impressive.
I thought you'd like
it. I'll use your phone now, if I may.
Certainly. There you are.
Thank you. Lobby, please. House phone number 1. Al Drury?
Yeah, right here, Paul.
You can take the watch off the Farnsworth house, but better keep somebody on at the clinic. Have you checked again with Charlie Bennett?
Yeah, just hung up. His wife's still missing. What does your boy have to say?
Ross Farnsworth dined at El Español last night during the wedding. He was with a party of 7 from 6:45 until after 8 o'clock. He can prove it.
Well, then, it's what we figured. Mrs. Bennett winged a shot at Miss Lacey. What do you want to do about Farnsworth? Drop it?
On the contrary. There's still some questions.
Good. Now, you wait there. I'll be right up.
Right. Thank you.
I'm trying to place that name, Charlie Bennett. Not Charles Z. Bennett. Not Penelope's paramour.
That's a pretty strong word, Ross.
Oh? Well, what do you call Mr. Bennett? Her boyfriend? Well, I know. Her chum. Penelope's chum is married. His wife is jealous. You all leap to the wrong conclusion. What juice for the headlines. Now, who can that be?
You get it, Hank.
Yeah, right here.
Come in, Al. Ross, this is Alfred Drury of the Detective Bureau.
A few questions about your general health, Mr. Farnsworth. Would you mind coming down to the Bureau?
I'm staying right here.
Let's not have any trouble. There you are, Farnsworth, my boy. Come along.
We'll return in just a moment to One Man's Family.
This is Jim Amici. Are you from Delaware? Did you know this state was named after Sir Thomas West? Perhaps it'd be easier to understand if we told you that Sir Thomas West was Lord Delaware. Delaware has the lowest elevation of any state. On this lowland are grown a wide variety of fruits and vegetables that help make Delaware a pioneer in food canning. Fishing also is very important to the economy of the small state. Delaware's poultry farms supply chickens to many of the large eastern markets. The Blue Hen State is important for the manufacture of chemicals, textiles, and paper. Its port of Wilmington was the site of the launching of the first iron seagoing propeller-type vessel. Delaware, the first state to sign the Constitution of the United States, has contributed much to the heritage of America. In the years ahead, Delaware will add much to America's future.
On the second floor of the private clinic on California Street, Miss Penelope Lacey, wakeful in the dim light of her hospital room, hears the murmur of familiar voices beyond the swinging door.
Nurse! Nurse!
Never mind, Miss Simpson. I'll go in. Come here, Uncle Paul.
Go ahead. I want to check the corridor.
Oh, I'm dying of thirst. That stupid nurse puts the glass way over where I can't reach it. Hank, I want to get out of here. I want to go home.
Now, one thing at a time. Here you are, honey. Sip that.
More?
All you want.
Thanks. How long do I have to stay here?
Well, I'll put it right here. There. Now fill it up before I go. Now then, how do you feel?
This cut on my face.
There won't be a scar, if that's your worry.
You guarantee it?
Sure.
What about the cut on my shoulder?
Well, we'll know more in a couple of days.
The nurse said it wasn't a bullet.
No, flying glass.
Somebody said the bullet went through the window twice.
Yeah, it made a small, neat hole in the right-hand corner, about a foot from where you were standing.
Oh.
Then it hit the brick wall outside and ricocheted back and shattered the glass in the lattice work. And you were lucky.
I heard my mother scream and then the shot and the crash and then I could feel blood inside my dress. Oh, it was horrible. It's like other people's troubles that you read in the papers. Will this be in the papers tomorrow?
You don't have to read them.
Are they out already? Does it say Ross fired the shot?
No.
Was it, Ross?
Look, let's talk about this in the morning, huh? Here's a friendly little white pill.
Hank, Charlie Bennett called me.
Oh, yeah? When?
Oh, tonight, to see if I felt better. Do the police know his wife hasn't been home all day?
Well, I guess the police know everything about everybody.
And it wasn't Ross. Answer me, it wasn't, was it?
Well, Ross seems to have an airtight alibi.
That's what I figured. This won't be a story about Joan and Ross and Ray Borden. It isn't their triangle. It's going to be about Charlie and Zenith Bennett and me. And we'll be spread all over the papers. And, well, what about this? What's to prevent her walking in here and blazing away?
The corridors are guarded.
By those same bright policemen they had at my mother's?
No, Al Drury sent men from the Bureau. Now, look, you're safe here, Penny. So stay, is that clear? Don't wander the corridors and don't start for home until I give you the word. Now, that's an order.
Yes, Hank.
Okay, now take this. Here's a sip of water. Ready?
Mm. Leave word, I don't want to see the morning papers ever.
Okay, honey. There you go. We see.
More of the Barbers in just a moment.
This might sound a little confusing at first, but if you've heard of a library having been woven well, you might credit the United States Officers' Wives Club, formerly at Wheelis Air Base, for inventing the idea. The women got interested in a school for some 300 homeless boys under the jurisdiction of the Libyan government. The school had native teachers, but had precious little in the way of essential educational aids. The fact they didn't have a library started the wheels of progress in motion. The Officers' Wives Club could easily have raised a fund for books, The members decided this wasn't the sensible thing to do under the circumstances. The boys were just learning to read and write, and it would take a while before they could use a library and realize its value. So instead of books, the club bought the school a loom and a supply of yarn. The plan called for the boys to learn how to weave barakan, the soft cloth used by native women to make dresses, and a popular fabric with Westerners who managed to visit Libya. Proceeds from initial sales of the material were invested in more yarn until a sizable stock existed. Then the school diverted the profits for books. Not only did the boys help earn their own library, but they also got vocational training in weaving. One of the wives of the club was asked how they happened to hit on this particular idea. She replied, "It just evolved." Elaborating a bit, she explained that the members of the club thought it was a good step toward getting Libya's future citizens to recognize the fact that Americans wished them well, and that they were willing to do what they could to help their immediate needs. Plainly, she added, "We can do with more knowing in North Africa these days. Yes, these homeless boys of Libya can hold their heads up and be proud they had the chance to earn their own library and keep it growing with a loom and a supply of yarn. These United States officers' wives gave us all a thought to remember. We are Americans. As we go, so goes America."
Taking elaborate precautions against waking the household at 3 o'clock in the morning, Paul and Hank tiptoe up the stairs, past Hazel's door, past the master bedroom, and so on up to the studio, painstakingly avoiding the third step from the top, the one that squeaks. But then, to their surprise, they find a light glowing under the door.
Dad!
Hey!
Here is a message for you. Nicholas telephoned. I can't sleep anyway. I was here looking for a book when the telephone rang. Nicholas would like one or both of you to come over to his house before you go to bed. That is, unless you are too tired.
Oh, certainly not. We'll go.
Oh, did he say why?
To me? Oh, of course not. He did what he could to sound casual at this hour. He and Claudia can't sleep either. They've made a pot of tea to post-mortem the evening. Yes, yes. Very casual. Bertie hung up while I was still talking and forgot to say goodbye. Now, that's not like Nicholas. I would say it was urgent.
Come on, Hank.
Good night, Grandfather.
Yes. You'll find me right here, wide awake and waiting for the news when you get back.
One Man's Family, which comes to you Monday through Friday, is written by Harlan Ware and directed by Carlton E. Morse. This program has been selected to be heard by our armed forces overseas through the worldwide facilities of the Armed Forces Radio Service. In Chapter 38, Book 133, The Woman on the Bridge. Frank Barton speaking. One Man's Family, winner of 47 national awards, now in its 27th year, is a Carlton E. Morse production and comes to you from California.
One Man's Family has come to you through the worldwide facilities of the United States Armed Forces Radio and Television Service.